all of you. This was the week that school started for me, and I'm going to indulge in telling you a little, hey Steve, a little story of what happened this week. And in order to do so, that means I have to teach you a little chemistry, and that's not always well received, but I'm going to do it anyway. Usually in one of the first 2 days of class, I try to get my students to start thinking about the periodic chart. It's a big leap sort of in the middle of the deep end, but I do try to do that. And I explain to them that on the periodic chart, there are almost no elements that are doing what they really want to do when they're all by themselves as an element. And those are the noble gases. If you can picture a periodic chart, some of this may come back to you if you've ever studied this, just to the left of the noble gases are elements that if they could just get another electron or two, they'd be happier than they were. To the right, which means you go to the other side and come back, there's elements that if they could just get rid of an electron or two, they'd be happier than they were. And basically nobody on the periodic chart, except for these few, are doing what they really want to do. Now, that's what I want to get across to them. Okay, so I've given you, this is the point of the whole thing. But this is the way I do it. I ask them if they know John Madden. And a few of them do. He's sort of fading off the scene now. Very successful coach in the NFL and then a commentator, most notably on Monday Night Football. And I tell them that it was John Madden's job, as it is for every announcer, to keep the audience tuned to that channel because you want to deliver that audience to the advertisers. So if a game is deadly dull, it's incumbent upon the announcers to do something that will keep audience interest. And so there was this one game that I saw that was deadly dull. It was deadly dull. And John Madden, doing his job, had the camera no longer look at the game. Why would you want to bother with that? But he focused on a defensive lineman. And I would stop and say to the class, now what does a defensive lineman look like? And the answer needs to include the word mountain somewhere. He focused on this defensive lineman. And he says, this guy has always wanted to be a wide receiver. And then I asked my class, what does a wide receiver look like? And the answer is a gazelle. And so he took the camera and focused on a wide receiver. And he said, the wide receiver has always wanted to be a middle linebacker. And I pause and say, now what does a middle linebacker look like? And the answer is a block of granite. Right? And then they say, well, they focus on a middle linebacker. He's always wanted to be this. This one's always wanted to be that. Quarterback wants to be this. The halfback wants to be that. Nobody is doing what they really want to do. And I thought that was the most profound statement I'd ever heard and realized it applied to the situation I was trying to get across. So this week, as I usually do, the first day of classes, the first 10 minutes of this, I'm doing this with my class. Okay? And I come to the point where I say, what does a defensive tackle look like? And third row back, there's two guys, one on either side of an aisle. They point to their right to a third guy, and they say, looks like that. And I was so concentrated on, you know, doing what I want to do, I didn't catch the significance of that right away. So I move on ahead in the story, and I say, now what does a wide receiver look like? And the two over this, including the guy that just had been pointed to, point back this way and say, look like that. It's starting to dawn on me what's happening here. And I get a little bit further and I say, now what does a middle linebacker look like? And the two on the outside point to the guy in the middle. Looks like that. I hit all three of those. I hardly ever have football players in my class. First of all, they don't take chemistry. And secondly, if they do take chemistry, they don't take me. And I got three of them. Right? They're red shirt freshmen, all three of them. They're sticking together. They want to get some. We've already had some good conversations and all that. I went to the game yesterday. Sorry about that, but I did. I went to the game yesterday, and I borrowed a program from somebody who had a program nearby, and I looked up the defensive tackle, who at the end of class, by the way, made me feel very small. Okay. He's listed in the program as 6'8", 336. That is what a defensive tackle looks like. He happens to be an offensive tackle, but, you know, what's the difference? Okay, that's what... You guys looked a little small yesterday. And I will remind you, he didn't play. He's not quite big enough, not quite ready to draw that
conversation. I'm dying to hear that. Did you tell your students about the ignorant versus stupid? And what? How did they react?
I actually didn't. I got so bummed.
Oh,
I didn't go back and do that. Yeah, no,
I
wanted to do that.
The important thing is your analogy held up.
Oh, yeah. It was as perfect as it's ever been. What does the defensive tackle look like? Looks like that.
Well, you got it for 3 more years, just the first day of class.
Yeah. But these are really interesting guys. One is black, two is white. The black kid is named Deshaun Tibbs. My intention is to call him Mr. Tibbs every time I speak to him. Some of you are old enough to know why. I don't think he knew, but I said, you need to go watch that movie and understand. If I say Mr. Tibbs, that's as respectful as I know how to be. Okay, we are at 1 Corinthians, and we reached chapter 3. This is a big...
First Kings.
First Kings, you can tell I'm distracted. We've reached First Kings, and that's a big deal because we're starting a new book. We had reached First Kings. We had done just a little bit. I want to do that again and give you a little bit of context here. So, chapter 3, verse 1, David has now died. He has been buried. Solomon is now king and pretty securely king. And what's the first thing he does? Mine does not say he marries somebody. It says he becomes the son-in-law of somebody because that was the more important thing, building that relationship. It says he became the son of... Yours says that? Well, I'm just telling you mine doesn't.
He married Pharaoh's daughter.
Right. Mine says he became the son-in-law of Pharaoh. But in order to do that, he must have married... Take your choice how you word it. But what was the reason for that? To build a political alliance. Therefore, she became a good, active Jewish young lady, right? I don't think so. And that's part of the problem. He married Pharaoh's daughter. That's the second thing. The first thing it says is he became the son-in-law. Mine then says he married Pharaoh's daughter. Does yours do both halves of that or just one half?
Solomon arranged a marriage contract with Pharaoh.
Yeah, okay. That's the first part.
He married Pharaoh's daughter.
I think she usually carries the message. The people, however, mine says however, were still sacrificing on the high places because at that time a dwelling place for the name of the Lord had not yet been built. What's that going to be? That's going to be called the temple, and we sometimes call it Solomon's temple because he was the one who built it. Verse 3, Solomon loved the Lord. He followed the precepts of his father David, except... That's a terrible word, especially in that context. He was doing great, except, and then it says he offered sacrifices and incenses in the high places. Now, let me make sure you understand what that means. That means he was worshiping God in a way that would look like he was doing so to the best of his ability, but he was also making offerings and sacrifices to false gods. There's a disconnect within his spiritual life that's there. Okay? Take a time out for a minute. There's a break between that and verse 4. And that, if you have a study Bible, it may show such a break. If you don't, it may not. Verse 4, he goes to the place where God's worship is centered. This is a place called Gibeon. And when he gets there, he makes a sacrifice to God, right? Please say no.
No.
What did he make?
To the high place.
No. It says there he went to sacrifice there, and the picture is that this particular offering, it's also on a high place. That's true. But this particular one was an offering to God. But it wasn't one offering. What was it?
A thousand.
1,000 offerings. That's what I want you to see. Why would you offer 1,000 offerings? Because you think one is not going to get God's attention, and you're pretty sure 50 is not. And you're sort of escalating. There's a little bit of a hint of obedience and sort of overwhelming response. There's also a little hint of need and worry in that. Now, of all the places we have been for the last month or two and the places we're going to be for the next month or two, we're about to hit the highest of the high points that we will reach. Verse 5, at Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in what context?
A dream.
You could use the word vision here, and it might communicate a little better to you. Because this is real. This is not sort of imagination. He appeared to Solomon in a dream or a vision during the night. Saturday afternoon, if I'm sitting there reading something, there's a good chance I'll take a nap and I might dream, and it wouldn't be at night. So the Bible writer is helping me know this one was, he's sleeping when he's supposed to be sleeping. God said something to him. What did he say? What do you want me to give you? Tell me what you want me to give you. Ask what you would like me to give you. Now, pause for just a second. What have we been taught, if we know something about this, what is Solomon about to ask for?
Wisdom.
He's about to ask for wisdom. That's what we should be looking for, right? So the next sentence should say, oh, I'd like you to give me wisdom, right? That's not the next sentence. In fact, it's not any one of the next five or six or seven sentences. What's the first thing Solomon says? And remember, he's still in this vision-like state. Doesn't say he's come out of that yet. What does Solomon say? The first thing is, he remembers. And what does he remember? He is speaking to God, and he's remembering God's faithful love to who? To David. Do you remember the Hebrew word that means faithful love, at least the way mine translates it? Bravo. A few of you remember. H-E-S-E-B. Hesed. What are the closest words that the New Testament would have? They would be the words that get translated love or agape and grace. Those, somewhere around those two words would be where this word hesed is. So listen carefully. Solomon replied, "You showed most faithful love to your servant David, my father, when he lived his life before you in faithfulness, uprightness, and integrity of heart." So there's the first thing he remembers. I remember what you've done for my father David.
Bill, is that a little revisionist history? I mean, David didn't seem to be particularly faithful.
I would love for you to keep your eye on that. I would love for you to keep your eye on that, because I think God says a little bit that you could almost think was sarcasm or sort of with a chuckle before this paragraph is over. It's not now. It's quite a bit further on. But I think God comments on that line. David wasn't perfectly, consistently, never varying in his faithfulness or his uprightness or his integrity. And yet God said of him, "This is a man after my own heart," and works with him in a way he's worked with almost nobody for a long time. Maybe Samuel, but not in the same way. So there is certainly something to it, but he does not seem to be recognizing or commenting on David's lapses. So far, okay? Mm-hmm. So what's the first thing he remembers? He remembers God's faithful love to his father David.
Bill, yeah. Can I insert just a little comment?
Certainly.
There's a preposition in there. In mine, it's translated as when I heard Dr. Meyer say it was when. And so maybe Solomon is acknowledging that when David did this, when David behaved and was faithful, then Solomon was able to observe God's hesed love toward him. So it was easier for Solomon to see when David was complying.
And I think that's extremely good, but I don't think it's complete as it stands. Christ died for us even while we were sinners. I think the faithful love would have continued through there, but I think to be able to say, "I could see it most clearly when your faithful love lined up with his faithfulness," you could really see the power then. I think that might, and you're right, there is a when that's in here.
And we see that in our own lives. When we are aligned with God's plan, we see him work much more so than when we are off in our own direction.
Can I take just a second here? Did you hear the same sermon that we
did? Insert sermon here.
No, not insert sermon. I want to go dig out one thing in the sermon. What was the license plate?
Me or you.
How many different ways can you read that? The moment I heard that license plate, I had three that popped to my mind that were very, very, very different from each other. And if you're going to start to parse things, you're going to... That's what I'm trying to do. I made that comment to you, sir, just a few moments ago. Yeah, I made that comment to you just a little while ago. I feel like I've got a couple of kindred spirits in here because you're starting to tease apart the hidden pieces that you. Wait a second. You could read it this way. You could read it this way. Should I read them both? Okay. How was the license plate read? Me before you, and I'm sort of looking down your nose, right? What's another way it could be read? Now, remember, there was a big article in the newspaper this week, Twitter is destroying language and spelling. just keep that in mind. Grammar is just going away as we move into the Twitter age. How else could you have read that?
If you're talking about sacrifices for someone, me before you.
I could have read it the opposite direction. Yeah. I could have read it.
I thought it said, yeah. I am for you.
I am for you.
Just, yeah, that's a stop the B, make that a word of its own. It should be am, but it comes out. Yeah. Me, I'm for you. Me be for you. Split the beam of the floor. He said it that way, doggone him, and then he pulled it out.
Okay.
That's what I caught, right? Yeah. I'm for you. It could have been, but you have to separate the B and the four to make that work, right? And it could be, and this was the one that I haven't heard you talk about yet, it could be, I'm living my life on display before you. Do you see my Savior when I live my life before you? Those were the three I picked up.
Transparency thing.
Yeah.
Witness thing.
Yeah. I'm living my life before you. The speedy. And I'll tell you, there's a story that I was reminded of when we were doing this. There's a cop that saw a car doing this kind of thing, speeding through a school zone, barely missing this. And he pulls the car over, yanks the driver, who happened to be a young woman, out of the car, has her, you know, hands on the car and all this kind of stuff, has the guns out and all this kind of stuff. And after a little while, she finally identifies herself, and because it's pretty clear, he thinks the car has been stolen. You know, why did you think the car was stolen? He says, because I saw a Christian symbol on the back of the car. And with you driving like this, I just assumed you'd stolen the car. I remember that one when he said the thing about the last play. Okay, so...
Please.
You're doing what I need you to do, which is join me in trying to look at what's said. Get two or three different translations. That's what we're trying to do, but see what's here. In any event, the first thing is, I remember your faithfulness to my Father. Semicolon. You have continued this most faithful love to my Father by allowing a son of his to sit on his throne today. But he hasn't called attention to himself yet, right? Adonijah would have been okay. Absalom would have been okay. You've allowed his dynasty to continue another generation. Okay? And now he comes to the third thing. And now, Lord my God, you have made your servant king in succession to David my father. Not only have you allowed a son of his, you've allowed this son of his to be the one to sit on the throne. And do you notice the word that he's using both to describe his father back up in the verse 6 and to describe himself now? Sure. He's using the word servant, and if you want to put the whole of the sermon this morning, you can fit it into that spot. And then, middle of verse 7 is the word but. I am a very young man. What does yours say? I think some translations say a child.
A little child.
A little child. Some translations say.
As a little child.
Okay. Unskilled in leadership, mine says, which I think is a good translation for the thought they're trying to get across. Yours will have a little bit different words there, but I like that part. And here is your servant, a young man, very young man, mine says, unskilled in leadership. And here I am, surrounded with, watch the pronouns, your people, whom you have chosen, a people so numerous that its number cannot be counted or reckoned. I think he's maybe remembering David's census and the complications that came from that. So look again. Here is your servant surrounded by your people whom you have chosen. Verse 9. So give your servant a heart to understand how to govern your people. A heart to understand how to discern between good and evil. For how otherwise could one hope to govern such a great people as yours? We are not told. He's at least 12, probably. Probably more like 18 or 19, but we don't know. Okay, I saw several hands first, and I saw yours first.
The message says, give me a God-listening heart.
A God-listening heart. This is the paraphrase, the message, which is always a good one to go to after you've seen one of these to sort of lay alongside. A God-listening heart. Anybody else have one you want to follow?
NIV says them to distinguish between right and wrong.
Mine says to discern between good and evil. Yours says to distinguish between right and wrong.
Discerning heart through distinguishing.
Mine says, give your servant a heart to understand how to govern your people, how to discern between good and evil. And I suppose a heart to understand fits with both of those. For how could one otherwise govern such a great people as yours? What was God's reaction? Verse 10. What was God's reaction? He was pleased. And he speaks. Since you have asked for this, and you've not asked for, what's the first thing he could have asked for?
Long
life. What's the second thing he could have asked for? Riches or wealth. What's the third thing he could have asked for? Short lives for his enemies. Mine says you could ask for long life for yourself, or you could ask for the lives of your enemies, which is not to say that the lives of your enemies would continue, but that they would be cut off. But that you have instead asked for, here's the way mine words it here, discerning judgment. Yep. This is a place where, again, I want you to sort of think about, is there something you're seeing in your translation that would be worth praying? Discerning judgment for yourself. Here and now, I do what you ask. I give you a heart wise and shrewd as no one has had before and no one will have after you. And what you have not asked, I will give you too. Such riches and glory as no other king can match, and the implication is before or after. And I will give you a long life. If. Do you see that word if? How far back does that word if apply? Does it apply just to the long life, or does it just keep on going back? I don't know.
Well, in mind, the long life is conditional.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's clear the long life is conditional. The question is how far that condition extends back. Does it extend back to riches and glory? Does it extend back to wisdom and discernment? If you look at the life of Solomon, and he's doing some things that you would think he would have been smart enough to know these aren't good things to do. So maybe that condition. Now, what's the condition he calls for? And Rivers, I'm looking specifically at you because this is the place I'm saying God may have just a little, either a chuckle or maybe even a little sarcasm. What does he say? If you follow my ways, keeping my laws and commandments as your father David followed them. How did David do it? Following them. Sometimes wonderfully and sometimes not so good. Where is the bar that God is placing for Solomon?
Low.
It's not up here. It's pretty high because David clearly was doing some things no other king around had ever done. Right? His relationships with God was often, but it wasn't here.
It was within his human capability.
It was within his ability. And that's what I want you to see.
He's pointing out that Solomon is human.
And I don't know if it's a chuckle or a tinge of sarcasm in there, but I sense he is saying, I'm not asking for perfect obedience in everything, but I am asking. Here's where I think I can circle around and make a comment. I'm asking that your recognition of that as the ideal be there, that your commitment to do those things be there. And if a moment comes where you fail, that you realize, wait a minute, this I messed up, and come to me for forgiveness to fix that, to address that. Because that's going to produce a breach in our relationship that needs to be mended. Because I think that's the description of how David had followed this. He wasn't perfect, but when he failed, he acknowledged his failures, and he came to God rather than running away from God. Yes, Russell?
I was just thinking, we talked about what kind of parent David was, or discussed that a little bit a couple lessons ago.
We did. What was our conclusion, he asked?
Well, I never concluded too much.
Oh, I bet
he wasn't hearing that.
Hands off.
But at least he was involved enough that Solomon knew his love for God, and
that's fair.
And recognized that God was important.
How many of the other sons David had would have recognized that? I don't know that all of them would, but Solomon did, and I think it's at the very least it's interesting.
So, David, I struggle with the whole deal with Uriah and Bathsheba. Right, he committed adultery and murder. David did, and I don't remember him ever really asking for forgiveness for that. This may be my recollection.
When the child died,
he passed in grave for 7 days on his face and ashes.
I think what he asked for, again, I probably ought to get my sign out. I have a sign that says dangerous ground. But I think what David asked for was that the consequences for his sins fall on him and not on the child. And he prayed passionately for that for 7 days. But he never failed, as I see it, to acknowledge God's right to place the consequences of sin wherever God chose. So the recriminations when the child died did not come. Now, move that forward to when we looked at the census and the plague that followed. If you remember, one of the two places we looked over in 1 Chronicles for one of those two places, David said, I'm the one who has sinned. Why are the consequences of my sin falling on the people? Those consequences need to fall on me. I see that as the evidence of what I just said. But it's not perfectly clear. It is, I think, a conclusion.
Was Solomon Bathsheba's son?
Oh, yeah. He was the first one after the one that died.
And, you know, that's true, too, about, you know, how many times when we ask for forgiveness for a big sin, we're really hoping that we will be delivered from any consequences at all. But David, no, there are consequences coming.
You read the Psalms, and you hear David saying, I deserve everything you're doing to me, but part of what's happening to me is broken fellowship with you, and I recognize my need to have that restored. And these places where he says, look, I'm the one where the consequences should fall. They shouldn't fall someplace else, and yet they do. I think all of this speaks to a true and real picture of how human life works that David got. So even though he messed up, there's something about the way he messed up and the way he recovered from that that I do think sets an example that Solomon had picked up on. And I'm simply suggesting I'm not sure every one of Solomon's sons, every one of David's sons would have.
I have a question. This is significant. In this period of time, I think when you ask for a discerning heart, they didn't really see the intellect the way that we do. But I think a discerning heart has mercy, where a discerning mind only has right and wrong. Do you think that's possible? That it's really important that he gives a discerning heart over a discerning mind?
There is a place, and I don't think it's here, but there's a place somewhere where those two words are used, wisdom and understanding, both. As if each has something to add to what the other brings to the table. And so I think, yes, it's intellect as well as the quality of mercy.
Well, even the Amplified says in verse 9, I mean, and this is Amplified, this, you know, so it's kind of like the Message, but it says, it translates, give your servant an understanding mind and a hearing heart.
No. And I think that echoes a little of what the Message says. Okay. Verse 15, then Solomon woke up. It had been a dream or a vision. He returned to Jerusalem, stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and presented burnt offerings and communion sacrifices and held a banquet for all those concerned. We didn't mention in the first hour that his standing in front of the Ark was not something he was permitted to do. That was something that only one priest at a time was allowed to do on behalf of the people.
But there is, he's in the Holy of Holies.
Well, the implication is he's either in there or he's facing the building where it's on the other side of a curtain wall. And he is recognizing, I want to go to the visible symbol of God's presence. And I want to make my worship there. He's been at the place the people were offering, which was the high places, which has that tinge of not quite right. And he's coming back to do this right. Okay? Now, I want to move quickly because I'd like to go all the way through chapters, the rest of chapter 3, chapter 4, and part of chapter 5 before we finish. And I do believe we can do this, and I'll show you why in just a second. Okay. Starting at verse 16, immediately upon saying God had granted him wisdom and understanding, it gives you an example of a case, a legal case that he dealt with. There are a lot of people who talk about why was this case coming to the king. It wasn't just two women, it was two prostitutes. It would seem like this would not be a case that would make it that far. So either this was a case that the judges at lower levels would have said, boy, I don't know what to do with this one, and pushed it up the line, and maybe it came that way. Maybe Solomon saw this one being tossed around and said, listen, bring that one in here. Let me deal with it. I don't know how this came to his attention. The picture is clear. Two prostitutes each have a child within 3 days of each other. They are sleeping in such a way that the child is sleeping next to them. One of them rolls over on her child and the child is suffocated during the night. The woman wakes up and realizes this, quickly swaps the baby before the other one wakes up. And in the morning, one baby is dead, one baby is alive, and the one that's alive is being claimed by the woman who is not his mother. But all you have is she said, she said, when you go into a court of law. What was Solomon's conclusion? Go get a sword, cut the baby in half, give each one a half of the baby. And the mother, who wasn't the child's mother, says, good idea. And the one who was the child's mother says, no, let her have the baby. Better the baby should live. And Solomon says, that's the mother. Look at the conclusion. Verse 28. All Israel came to hear of the judgment which the king had pronounced and held the king in awe, recognizing that he possessed divine wisdom for dispensing justice. Now, between there and some place late in chapter 4 or early in chapter 5, there are a couple of little things, and I just want quickly to summarize them. There is first a listing of the officials, and I think there's a listing of officials that includes some who had been officials and some who now were. So it lists who the priest was, who the secretaries were, who the herald was. Verse 4 in my translation is a parenthesis. I think it says who the commander of the army had been and who the priests had been, because remember, one of those priests was now in exile. You know, you have to be in your home and you're wearing the ankle bracelet, so to speak. Verse 5 has Nathan's son, who is listed as chief administrator. And in my translation, another of Nathan's sons has the most fascinating title I know of. In my translation, he is called Friend of the King, and Friend is capitalized. What a great, great title. Anyway, come down to verse 7. It says that Solomon had 12 administrators. For what purpose? Each one was responsible for putting food on the king's table and putting equipment and other things under the king's control for 1 month out of the year. And where are they chosen from all over the nation? Why? Because that means one part of the nation was responsible for 1 month. You go all the way back to Moses, you go back to Samuel. Each had warned the people, if you get a king, this is what the king is going to do. He's basically going to eat you out of house and home. He's going to take your crops, he's going to take your food, he's going to take your daughters to be wives or concubines, he's going to take your sons to be soldiers or to be slave laborers. you're just going to have to give and give and give to keep that king going. And boy, here we go. He's going to have glory and power like you've never seen, but it's being because he's sucking at the economy for all that's there. So far, okay? And it gives details on who's who. There's a section that's either between verse 22 and 27 of chapter 4, or it's somewhere in chapter 5 that talks about what they had to bring for each of these. Do you see that? I'd like to dispense with that quickly, but you see it there, right? It is chapter 4, verse 20, I think, that says Judah and Israel were numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate and drank and were very happy. You find that? I believe it's still in chapter 4, verse 29. God gave Solomon immense wisdom and understanding. That's where he uses those two words side by side, Linda, that I was talking about just a second ago. And a heart as vast as the sand on the seashore. I find it interesting he's using the same word for the people as well as for his heart. The wisdom of Solomon surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east. That would be towards Persia. And all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than anyone else. Then it names some specific people he was wiser than. He composed Proverbs, how many?
3,000.
He composed songs, how many? 1,005. He could talk about plants from the cedars of Lebanon to the hyssop growing on the wall. He could talk about animals and birds and reptiles and fish. Mine says he could discourse on them. It means he could stand up and give you a learned speech about details of these things. Men from all the nations came to hear Solomon's wisdom, and each of them brought gifts from the kings of the world.
Anybody that listened to him could say that they were
ignorant. Right. Now, wherever that leaves off, and I think it leaves off first verse of chapter 5 is the next thing. The next thing is the king of Tyre, a guy named Hiram, begins to send to him the materials and the skilled craftsmen to start to build the temple. So that's the spot. Everybody okay? All right. I'm going to pause at that point and say your assignment for next time is to read the whole of 1 Chronicles. Because 1 Chronicles ends here. And 2 Chronicles starts here with the building of the temple. So what I propose to do the next time we're together, which I hope will be next week, is we're going to go quickly through the whole of 1 Chronicles, which overlays 1st, 2nd Samuel, and this much of 1st Kings. We're going to just make sure we see the spots that are in there. That means we'll revisit a few things, look at a few things. I want you specifically to look for what's said about Issachar. You may have to hunt to find that. And toward the end, I want you to look at all that David had done to get ready for the building of the temple. When God said you can't build the temple, he didn't just stop. He kept going, putting together everything, and I mean everything, that Solomon would need to actually do the building. And I want you to see what all that was, because that's there. Okay? So that's where we're going to go next time. Let's have a word of prayer as we finish. Our Father, we realize that what you did with Solomon, you're willing to do with any of us. You're willing to open our heart to bring your spirit inside, but we have to be willing to accept him. We have to be willing to listen and follow his guidance. And we realize that you're asking us to follow your laws and your ways in a way that makes them important to us so that when we mess up, we come to you and say we messed up. And pray to you that our fellowship, our relationship would be restored as it had been before. Because that's what you mean when you say followed as David followed. We thank you for this insight coming through Solomon. And we pray that you would bring us back together next week to study a little more. All this we pray in your son's name. Amen.